Chapter 8.
The Trakad is primitive. We thought that you wanted state-of-the-art technology, and that is why you allied with us. What is the point of this machine?
Sas Sikili, negotiator of the Roach Hives to Jir Yomaget, head of Mandel Motors, on seeing hollow images of the Trakad prototype multi-mission combat vessel. Office of the Joint Chief of State, Coruscant. Kytus ran his fingertips over the nameplate on the outer doors and wondered when he would have the engraving changed to replace Colonel Jason Solo with Darth Kytus. Would he need a plate on the door, or even an office at all? He'd still intended to leave the routine business of government to Neothel, but she was becoming an irritant, and it was time he started looking for an administrator to take over just in case he had to retire her. Kytus hoped she might see sense and return to Mon Calamari, or even accept a transfer back to operational duties with the fleet. But she had tasted power, and few were willing to slide back into taking orders when they'd given them. Flesh and blood were heir to ambition. He liked ambition in an apprentice or junior officer, but the closer it crept to his own rank, the more it got in the way of the tidy business of running a peaceful, stable galaxy. Keeping a constant eye out for usurpers was time-consuming and distracting. He was beginning to prefer the service of droids. A legal droid had enabled him to exploit the law to grab power, and it expected no favors or high office in return. It simply did its job. Maybe he needed a droid administration.
Just one more push. Just one more to break the back of resistance. Make an example of Fondor.
The Imperial Remnant was joining him, and that made all the difference. Kytus's sense of standing on the brink of a pivotal moment was growing stronger. The state of galactic allegiances might not have looked in his favor numerically, but the recruitment of the Moffs to his cause was a coup. Their military weight was what he'd wanted most, but their sphere of influence, which also included the banking centers of Munalinst and Mygeeto, was a prize in itself.
I have resources, should I need them, but I can also choke off the resources of others. Economics is a weapon, too.
Tahiri, he said.
Where have you been?
Tahiri sat down in the chair facing his desk, now looking the ideal junior lieutenant. She'd even pinned up her hair.
I thought you could tell. Can't you detect me?
Kytus activated the holochart and magnified the Fondor system, moving asset icons into different positions.
I don't have time to keep an eye on everyone. And talking of detection, are you any farther forward with locating the Jedi Council's base?
No, I am not, sir.
Why?
There's a lot of galaxy to search, and the StealthX needs regular maintenance. I lost one day already.
I realize the service schedule seems to have been stepped up, but that doesn't explain the lack of results from a Jedi.
Sir, that's unfair.
Tahiri was taking her new military status seriously. She hadn't called him Jason in days.
If this is a priority, then you have far more powerful force senses than me, and you should be able to locate them. I still think they'd bolt to one of their old haunts.
Kytus didn't think Luke was so unimaginative, and would know that, of course. So he might do it, and head for somewhere like Hoth or Endor, as much to relive some sad nostalgia for his youth as to hide. But Luke would also know that searching Hoth or some force-forsaken wilderness would tie up Kytus's scarce elite resources, and so he would be happy for Kytus to believe he was a fool, or have him lock himself into indecision trying to guess Luke's strategy.
I will not give Luke the satisfaction. He's yesterday's man. I do not dance to his tune. He'll want us to waste time searching his old haunts,
Kytus said.
So we won't.
He moved star destroyers and frigates around the Tapani sector chart with his fingertip, considering his options for bringing Fondor back into line. In some ways, it mattered more than Corellia. Corellia had always been a thorn in every government side, a planet of hobby dissidents who didn't care who ran the show or what the policies were, as long as they could rebel against them. Perhaps the worst thing to impose on Corellia was a regime in Coruscant that agreed with them on their every whining objection, sending them into a spiral of confusion. But Fondor was psychologically different. It was a regular world, usually a compliant and responsible world, and so its secession from the GA was a more dangerous signal to others in the GA. Kytus was sure this had emboldened other systems to break ranks. He had to be seen to crack down now, something he should have done months ago, had he not been distracted by more domestic matters.
I haven't thought about Alana for hours, or Tenel Ka. If I try hard, I can forget them. In time. After we take back Fondor, I'll join you in hunting him,
Kytus said. He didn't plan to make the same mistakes as he had with Corellia, by listening to weak-willed bureaucrats who didn't have the stomach for a fight.
I told Cal Omis we should crush Corellia right away and nip the rebellion in the bud. It's his fault for limiting me, and Neophil's. I've proven my point. Either you put out a forest fire right away, or it goes on burning underground, even when the surface vegetation is ash.
Kytus knew all about forest fires now. He liked the analogy. Just as the real forest fires on Kashyyyk would enable new healthy growth to spring up again, so did purging the old order of chaos and petty planetary politics.
After Fondor. Are you spending any time around fleet personnel?
Sorry.
I meant, do you listen to the mood on the lower decks?
I ate in the mess at HQ a couple of times. Yes.
And?
Kytus made himself forget Fondor for a moment and stepped back, eyes closed, to quiet his mind and focus on a randomly chosen point in time and space. The junior ratings mess in Fleet HQ. If he shut out everything else, he could sense the collective mood of fleet personnel, taste the blend of anticipation, fear, curiosity, loneliness, even the worries about pay and promotion, as if it was one entity. He sank deeper into the swirl of light, sound, and texture, sensing the mess as white noise. And then snatches of specific emotions and chatter welled up from the blur in sharp clarity.
I don't believe it.
It's true, I tell you. He killed her, snapped her neck.
He's the best officer we ever had. He cares.
He killed her, I tell you. Tebbutt was all right. If he can kill her...
Lots of people have ended up dead since he took over. Omis, Gedgen... Luke Skywalker's wife?
Don't be stupid. She was family.
Kytus snapped out of the listening trance, and his office looked dead. Its colors washed out for a moment. He was furious.
I killed Mara. They're saying I killed her. She came after me. She was trying to kill me. If I hadn't killed her, I'd be the one getting a state funeral now. Destiny steered by the Force or not, she tried to kill me. She was an assassin. It was all she ever was, all she was destined to be, for the purposes unfolding now.
He felt his face flush, hot and hurt. The strength of his reaction shocked him. He could face himself when he shaved each morning, and however many lives this war was costing, he did what he had to do. Each life spent was to save many others, and he would not apologize for it, or be regarded as a common criminal.
"Sir, are you okay?"
Kytus settled himself and embraced the temporary distress as another inevitable pain in the road to mastering the Sith way. If he couldn't feel stung and wounded, if he could ignore the barbs, then he couldn't harness the passions a Sith had to feed upon. They were his strength. The pain was his strength. If only Ben had realized the value of pain. He was so much sharper, more thoughtful, more worthy than Tahiri, for all his sentimental shortcomings.
"Where will I find the right one? When will I find a deserving apprentice?"
It would have to wait.
"I shouldn't have to do the foot soldier work, Tahiri. Be my eyes and ears. I'd hate to have to use Chahala trees. You're smarter than a tree, aren't you?"
"Yes, sir," she said, and her resentment tasted like sour vattel juice at the back of his tongue.
That was a positive sign, better than the needy desperation that had motivated her to effort only when she wanted to see Anakin again. If she was going to be more than just an errand runner, he had to find the durasteel in her spine, some powerful emotion that would make her fight back and even challenge him. Her fire, her drive, needed to come from her living self, and not from a dead boy she could never have. It was unhealthy, this fixation with what was gone forever. Kytus sometimes felt uneasy using the flow-walking bait, but it was just a way of placing Tahiri in the right position so he could then show her something real and lasting. It was a necessary, temporary evil.
"Then you'll understand this," he said.
He beckoned her over to the holochart table, even though she could easily see the plot if she twisted in the chair.
"Come here. See my strategy for Fondor."
Kytus moved clouds of small icons like miniature star clusters into an irregular ring around Fondor.
"Your strategy."
Tahiri wasn't cowed down by Kytus's verbal slaps.
"Good."
She was still smarting and angry.
"Is Admiral Neothel not involved?"
"Who runs the state while I'm away? We need to avoid having both chiefs away at the same time, unless there's an overwhelming crisis away from Coruscant that demands it."
Kytus thought of how often they'd both not only been off-planet, but in the same engagement.
"No attempt to overthrow us, though. How compliant beings can be. She's aware of my plans."
"But you trust her enough to turn your back on her."
"My back,"
Kytus said,
"is never turned, no matter where I am. Sowing seeds of doubt, either because she wants to rattle me, or because she's genuinely suspicious. Both worthy of a Sith. Perhaps Tahiri has turned a corner at last."
"So what am I looking at?"
she asked. Kytus sensed Neothel coming along the corridor. Her timing was impeccable. She must have seen Tahiri pass the lobby outside her own office.
"The small icons are mines,"
he said.
I'm not making the same mistake as we did in blockading Corellia. Then we still deluded ourselves that we could bring the planet to its knees by maintaining a civilized picket line, like some customs and excise operation. No, that eats resources, especially when there's a ring of orbital stations to isolate from both planet side and space side. When I deploy warships and fighters, it will be to wage war and fight, not to be run ragged stopping Confederates from walking on the grass. I'm taking the first element of the Fourth Fleet to Fondor today. The Minelayers have already left.
Around the whole planet?
That's the only option. Mining the main transits from the Rimmer trade route simply allows supply vessels to bypass the minefields, or catches the careless ones. And while I want to deter commerce from supporting Fondor, there's nothing to be gained in alienating the trade worlds with civilian casualties.
Neothel's presence blew in like a storm building on the horizon a few moments before she appeared. Kytus and Tahiri paused and turned together.
Bad form, yes, I agree. No dead civilians.
Neothel walked over to the chart, hands clasped behind her back. In her pristine whites and gold braid, she was the quintessence of admiralty, as she cocked her head to study the holoschematic chart of the system. Kytus knew that Mon Cal's eyes were positioned so that the tilt was necessary to focus closely. But to a human, the gesture always smacked of doubt, as if she thought he was the dim boy in the class who never got the right answer.
"So the impenetrable ring of detonite, eh, Jason?"
She turned to Tahiri.
"How smart you look in a proper uniform, my dear. Welcome to the fleet."
Kytus cut in. Neothel was in one of her irritating, smug moods, no doubt thrilled at the prospect of his absence.
"I'm deploying to Fondor tonight, remember. I'm sure you'll miss me."
"That begs a joke, but I'm no comedian."
"Five Minelayers should be in position a few hours ahead of the rest of the task force."
Jason glanced at the wall chrono.
"There'll be a shell around the entire planet when I get there."
Neothel extended a long, bony fin of a finger into the nest of tangled, glowing lines dotted with multicolored lights.
"Don't forget that you lay the inner ring first, though, will you?"
"Oh, you're too modest when you say you're not a comedian, Admiral."
Neothel felt as if she was savoring the carefully worded fight.
"And these won't be activated until we've warned Fondor and given a one-standard-hour general shipping alert, will they?"
"Not issuing a warning about planetary mine nets would be a war crime, Admiral, because of civilian traffic."
"That's why I ask. You're so forgetful lately. And we'll take the decision to activate jointly, won't we?"
"I'm a team player. I look forward to it."
He didn't need his force senses to tell him that she wouldn't miss him.
"I've put the Third Fleet Rapid Reaction Force on alert. So if you need help, do call."
"I'll give the blockade a week before we move to the assault phase."
"We didn't discuss that."
"Oh, I thought of it later."
"Why create a mine shell if you don't intend to sit it out? It's not as if we have hulls and troops to spare."
"Because I still think we should take the yards sooner rather than later. And we can pick them off once the planet is locked down. Then, when the yards are secured, I intend to capture the capital and main regional centers."
Yes, you did say that. But let me remind you that there are still 5 billion Fondorians, at least half of them on the planet's surface, and most in those cities.
I'm hoping it won't get to that stage. I may sacrifice 1 yard to show I mean business, but Fondor won't want its industrial infrastructure destroyed. Will it? Small, rich world. One that will see sense.
Corellia has an even smaller population. And look how well that went.
Neothel checked the splendid gold fob chrono on her jacket.
My, is that the time? I must be going.
She headed for the doors.
Wow,
Tahiri said, when Neothel was long out of earshot.
Are you two always that barbed with each other?
It's how we keep on our toes.
Kytus would have been much more worried if Neothel oozed sweetness and light to him. As long as he felt that she despised him, and he felt it, and she paraded her disdain openly, he knew he could still trust her not to attack him. She was much more transparent than he'd first expected.
She's actually very, very good at her job. I just wish she'd accept that she's not very good at mine.
You can feel her hatred. I certainly can.
It's not hatred, Tahiri,
Kaida said.
It's disdain, contempt, and a certain superior pleasure at being better and nicer than me, as she sees it. That's loathing, perhaps, not hatred. Hatred is close to fear, and always has an element of dread in it. Like love has a component of pity, and it's just as hard to see the line between the two.
Tahiri might have taken it at face value, or she might have been unpicking hidden meaning in it. He hoped she was doing the latter.
I'll turn to at 1800, she said,
as if she'd learned all the new jargon to impress him and possibly secure another fruitless, tantalizing glimpse of Anakin.
Sir?
She walked out of the office with a more rigid spine.
Perhaps she's choosing pain, too. You did well with Admiral Pelion, by the way,
he called after her.
Good job, Lieutenant.
Something else had just shifted in the Force. A small thing. A cog turned by just a single tooth, but it had moved. And with it, the rest of the machine was subtly altered. That was the nature of destiny. Kytus felt around in the Force for where Luke and his entourage might be, but his mind was too restless now, fixed on the need to bring down Fondor.
It will be a short siege, I promise. A decisive one.
He tried to search out his twin sister, just out of curiosity.
Jaina, I can't believe how easy it is to forget people. I can go for days without even remembering you exist. Jaina.
He reached out in the Force. But something else in the great machine had changed, too. He couldn't feel Jaina. Not the familiar mix of temper and passion and, always applied too late, the urge to control it all. Perhaps Ben had taught Jaina how to shut down in the Force, too, like he'd probably taught his mother so she could kill Jason Solo more efficiently. Kytus checked himself as he realized that he saw Jason as a separate entity. It was more than having changed. It was separation. Jason still existed for the family who tried to understand him, but he wasn't the man sitting here now.
Better not teach Tahiri to force hide. It just complicates matters. Jason Solo. Gone now. Not concealed. Gone. And never coming back.
Kytus spent the afternoon moving assets around imagined Fondor space, feeling fresh pleasure each time his finger connected with the amber lights representing the new assets, the battleships and fighter squadrons of the Imperial Remnant. This would not be the long, groaning, humiliating failure of trying to subdue Corellia. He had a good chunk of the Fourth Fleet, and nobody else was placed to come to Fondor's aid. Everyone else now had their own woes and war to keep them busy.
This time, it'll be different.
It would be different because there was no more Jason Solo, or any of his levers left to pull. And if there was no more Jason Solo, then Darth Kytus had no twin sister. Kytus relaxed. GA Fleet Hangar, Galactic City, 6 hours later.
We're on, said Shevu. The Anakin Solo has cleared orbit.
Ben could see Shevu on the monitor that was set in the CSF speeder's dash. He didn't know or ask how the captain had managed to borrow a police traffic patrol vessel, but it was handy cover for anyone who wanted to sit waiting at a skylane intersection near a military installation without drawing the wrong kind of attention. It was also linked to a network of skylane surveillance holocams. All Ben had to do was sit there and monitor the images that the forensics droid relayed from the interior of the Stealth X cockpit.
Okay, Ben said. Let me know if you need a spot of disruption.
Shevu adjusted his helmet as he walked toward the hangar's open doors. Yellow light spilled out onto the permacrete ramp.
If you ever take up a life of crime, Ben, you'll do staggeringly well at it. Just as well, Jedi are pretty honest.
Ben had learned that even for him, there was a principle of need to know. And he didn't need to know how far CSF was involved now. The police looked after their own, no questions asked. And as far as they were concerned, Shevu was still one of the lads, even if he now wore the black of the Galactic Alliance Guard. It was just a matter of slipping the CSF forensics droid into the Stealth X. It was a small sphere about the size of a smash ball, disturbingly like a thermal detonator, and packed into its innards were probes, spectrometers, reagents, sample packs, and a full array of sensors that recorded everything at the crime scene it was sent to record. It was perfect for sending into dangerous or inaccessible places that a flesh-and-blood CSF scenes of crime officer couldn't reach, and it was also small enough to be discreet. The only problem was that it didn't look like a maintenance droid, and someone might notice. Ben's job was to make sure they didn't. Shevu, in uniform and taking advantage of the fact that GAG officers could do as they pleased in Jason's new galactic order, ambled into the hangar, and the external traffic remote lost him in the shadow. There was a brief fog of static on the monitor as Ben switched from the traffic control holocam to Shevu's helmet cam.
"Here we go," said Shevu.
The forward image showed Jason's personal Stealth X sitting in its bay, canopy closed, in a line of X-wings connected to the diagnostic grid by cables and wires. Maintenance droids and a couple of human technicians walked in and out of eyeshot, looking harassed.
"Got the droid ready. I'm watching."
Ben followed Shevu's field of view as the captain walked up to the technicians and asked them when Colonel Solo's Stealth X was starting its maintenance cycle. They assumed they were being nagged to make the vessel a priority.
"Okay, we'll do it before the next batch of X-wings," one technician said in an exasperated tone. "Look, we can only process them so fast, you know."
"It's okay.
Shevu sounded as if he was relenting. I'll hang around, if you don't mind. You know what a pain in the neck he is about efficiency. The technicians lapsed into stunned silence, mouths slightly slack with horror. It was just a figure of speech, but with the gossip about poor Tebbutt doing the rounds of the fleet, it sounded like a very sick joke. They didn't seem sure whether it was safer to laugh at it or not. Armed Forces humor was very tasteless sometimes, right on the borderline between laughter and tears. Shevu shrugged and walked away. It was a perfect excuse for him to mooch around the hangar, looking as if he were killing time by sticking his nose in everywhere. He was a secret policeman. It was what they expected him to do. He clambered up the ladders on a couple of X-wings, prodded cables, and generally made all the movements of a man wanting to get on with something because he had a very unreasonable boss. Did the rest of the fleet still like Jason? A few days ago he'd been their hero, one of the team. He sent procurement managers to the front line for providing poor quality kit to the troops, or not providing it at all. He led from the front. He never asked his personnel to do anything he wouldn't do himself. This, Ben knew, was what created the loyalty that made beings put their lives on the line for an officer. It wasn't political fervor or a desire for glory. It was devotion based on shared risk, on knowing that comrades, whatever the rank, looked out for each other. But Jason hadn't looked out for him. He'd tortured him. Ben couldn't imagine doing that to someone he was supposed to care about, especially for their own good. "Do you really know how much he's changed, Jaina?"
"Ben, stand by."
Shevu's helmet link showed he was at the Stealth X now. It was one of three left. The Jedi had taken the others with them, and a Stealth X wasn't much use to non-Force users, seeing as they had to use comlinks. Ben watched Shevu's field of view shake with the 1, 2, 3 of climbing the small ladder up to the cockpit, and the flash of a transparent canopy lifting, followed by the dark interior and matte instrument panel as Shevu looked inside. "In the hole," Shevu muttered into his helmet link. Then he climbed back down and wandered apparently aimlessly around the hangar.
"Droid on the case."
Most of Ben's attention shifted to the monitor showing the droid's eye view of the cockpit. A fraction of it remained on Shevu's monitor, watching for complications that might require a little force ingenuity from Ben. He could see the smooth, matte black curves of the instrument panel, and the small brush-like projections from the droid skimming over plastoid and durasteel, picking up traces and analyzing them before storing the swabbed samples inside the case. An icon on the monitor showed the results as the droid worked, and there were traces of skin cells, machine lubricant, microscopic shavings of metals, and sweat from hands. There was even dust with the mineral profile of Kavin. But then Jason had landed to find Ben. It wasn't evidence. The droid worked methodically, covering the cockpit deck and bulkheads. It was picking up the odd hair, too, 5 centimeter lengths, short and male. Ben's heart sank. The cockpit must have been cleaned several times in the last few weeks. Then the droid worked over the apparently clean seat. Again, the icons showed skin cells, dust, oils. The probes worked down into seams, and then between the sections that formed the angle of the seat, deep folds of fabric. The icons changed. Particles: brick, origin unknown. Clay: silicates. Organic material: hair, female, 29 centimeters. Follicular tag present. Traces of blood on hair shaft. DNA matches hair.
"Oh, oh, oh," Ben whispered.
"Got it?"
Shevu's view showed he was near the doors, head moving slowly, as if watching nothing in particular.
What is it, Ben?
Hair with blood, and a follicular tag. Female hair.
If it's got a tag, Ben, it's probably been pulled out.
Ben saw his mother in his memory, tugging her hair and dropping strands into his palm as he stared dumbfounded at her ghost on Cavan.
You did it, Mom.
Let's get out, Ben said. We've got it.
Stang, said Shevu. When Ben switched his attention back to Shevu's monitor, he saw what had made him curse. Captain Gearden was walking toward him, hands deep in pockets, whistling soundlessly.
Walk him away, said Ben. I'll extract the droid.
Wait until he goes. I'll get rid of him.
No, just get him away from the Stealth X. Leave it to me.
Okay. Shevu's voice was now totally different, external, addressing Gearden. Keeping you up, are we?
Don't see you down here often, Gearden said.
Just making sure Solo's toy is ready if he decides to come back early. Don't want him to shake me warmly by the throat, do I?
Gearden made a snorting sound.
Ha, you're his little master perfect. He won't throttle you. Besides, he's going to be stuck at Fondor for a long time.
Shevu began walking away from the Stealth X very slowly, getting Gearden to follow him without even thinking. Ben watched Shevu's helmet cam shift perspective from the speckled, irregularly shaped fiberplast airframe of the fighter to a long view of the hangar with the X-wings staggered along the length of both walls, and waited until it had passed three of them before extracting the droid.
Am I stopping it too early? Will there be other evidence in there?
No. Ben had what mattered. The droid was self-propelled, but he gave it a little force assistance and plucked it out of the cockpit, moving it to the floor and then sending it out of the doors and into the night. Once it was clear of the hangar ramp, he lifted it into the air and pulled it to him as fast as he could, almost smacking it into the side of a passing repulsor truck in his haste. When it plopped onto the seat next to him in the traffic speeder, he couldn't stop himself clenching both fists and hissing,
"Yes, yes, yes!"
in triumph. Now all he had to do was wait for Shevu to get away from Gearden and meet up with him. He moved the speeder onto the next intersection and sat with one hand on the droid as if it were an obedient pet that had done a clever trick. Eventually he heard Shevu say,
"Hang this, I'll come back in the morning,"
and relief flooded his body. By the time Shevu called him for a pickup from the next skylane, the captain was wearing plain black coveralls without insignia or rank, looking like a CSF tactical weapons officer. He dropped Ben and the droid off two blocks down from the apartment and disappeared to return the CSF speeder. Ben wondered how flexible the CSF admin system had to be for some officer to loan vehicles to a buddy for a highly irregular operation that had nothing to do with CSF, not officially. Back in the apartment, Ben placed the droid on the table and sat staring at it as if it might make a dash for freedom, and almost expected his mother to appear to him again with some gesture of congratulation. But she didn't. And he was disappointed. For the first time since finding her body, though, he felt that she wasn't totally gone. She was simply in another place. Unlike most beings in the galaxy, he actually knew that to be true and real, not just a sincere hope. It meant he could go on now. He would, as he promised himself, live for her, and live well. That evening, he and Shevu ate their supper in silence. There was a sense of anticlimax.
"I'll play Palpatine's advocate," Shevu said, chewing slowly.
"The hair. First, you have to match it to your mother's,
Dad grabbed most of her stuff before he got out. He's got her brushes. Plenty of hair to match up DNA.
I was going on to say that you'd need to prove there was no other way that the trace could have got into the Stealth X.
It was on Jason's clothing.
Ben tried to imagine how his mother's hair got pulled out. She'd bled, though. He could see that when he found her.
They must have fought hand to hand. That's grim.
She hadn't got any traces of his skin under her nails or anything. So what were they doing for him to have grabbed her hair? Did he ambush her?
I don't know.
A defense lawyer would say that Jason might have picked up the hairs from you.
I didn't touch her body. It was a crime scene. I wanted to, but I knew it was important to leave things alone.
They'd say it's your word against Jason's.
Ben felt irrationally angry. And I'd say, look at the body of evidence I'm building up. But it's Dad, isn't it? You're asking me if this is going to be enough to convince him.
If I were still in CSF, I'd say it was enough for me to arrest him for questioning. At least.
And then it's circumstantial.
Take the droid, Chavu said. And let's get you back to wherever it is you're hanging out.
Ben opened his mouth to say Endor, but Chavu held up a hand for silence.
I don't need to know. Okay?
Ben pondered the nature of reasonable doubt. He was sure now. He didn't know if Dad would be. He really needed one more clincher. But he had no idea what else there could possibly be that would prove beyond any doubt that it wasn't Ali Marar who had killed Mara Jade Skywalker, but Jason Solo. Fleet HQ Operations Center, Coruscant. Neothel made sure she was a daily visitor to Fleet HQ, but this was her second trip today, made without notice. Her arrival had thrown the center into a quiet, barely noticeable panic. But it was panic all the same. Personnel tidied consoles and emptied cups of caff discreetly, thinking she wouldn't notice their attempt to bring the place up to captain's walkthrough standards by the time she looked up from the screen she was studying. They never seemed to realize how wide a field of vision Amon Kal had.
It's just caff. Forget it. We have much bigger problems.
Admiral, is there anything I can do?
The Sullustan Op Center commander hovered, uneasy at having a full admiral of the fleet ensconced in the ops room at a terminal, let alone one who was also Joint Chief of State. He had the air of someone who was waiting for the axe to fall, and to be told that he had failed a surprise inspection for reasons he would never grasp.
There's always a private office available for you.
Neothel could also have sat back in her own chair and watched Jason's progress on the repeater holochart in her suite at the Senate. But the big picture wasn't what she was interested in. She wanted to see the detail. She wanted to see the way crews were prepped and briefed before Jason jumped to hyperspace. And she wanted to see if he'd slipped in any little extras that he'd neglected to mention, like the way the timing of the assault had slipped his mind. It would take a month or more for the orbital yards to use up their supplies, and even then they had sufficient water recycling capacity to hold out for another month on half or quarter rations without resupply. Fondorian yards were staffed mainly by humans, who could live on very few calories for a long time as long as they were hydrated. A week was far too soon. She couldn't believe Jason hadn't learned the lesson of Corellia. She was sure he had. And if he was half as sly and resourceful as she knew, he would have gone with the intention and enough troops and materiel to move to the assault phases, orbitals, then planet, as soon as he could. Did he already know she was slipping information to Luke? Was this part of his test?
Stop thinking that way, or he's got you where he's got everyone else.
You're a better tactician than that. Don't you have oversight of Colonel Solo's plans?
Asked the commander. His name was Kenb, but she could only see the K and the E on his tunic, because his arms were folded tightly across his chest, creasing the fabric.
If there's anything wrong, if there is, then it's my problem rather than yours, Commander,
she said kindly. Calf cups scraped faintly. Flimsy rustled. When she turned her head, consoles were immaculate again.
I'm not Jason. You don't have to be afraid of me. I've been neglecting logistics, and I want to get up to speed again. Certainly, Admiral.
Sulliston faces weren't as obviously mobile and expressive as a human's, but she knew disbelief when she saw it.
Call me if you need anything.
Yes, in any normal government, the head of state and the defense secretary would discuss with the chiefs of staff how a major engagement was to be fought, and how it would be resourced. Yet here they were, a duumvirate combining all the roles of state and military, and still he was economical with information. It was rather like beings trying to pretend they were alone in a crowded turbolift. As long as eye contact could be avoided, the illusion of anonymous privacy held. Jason made vague noises about strategy, grabbed an assortment of ships, and ambled off to play. And she let him, because she had no idea how to stop him with her first shot. She'd only get one chance. Wounded, he'd be a terrible enemy.
And I want to see what you packed for your little trip.
Jason always had the Anakin Solo, of course. And Fondor was a relatively small world, a speck compared with Coruscant. Its neighbor, Nalastia, was even smaller, and might not even try to ride to the rescue. Neothel called up the holochart from Jason's office node and tried to work out what was inappropriate for Fondor. Because something didn't fit. Minds, especially the latest self-dispersing Mersan vigilante type, were quick and easy to lay, and Jason didn't need many ships to do it. Two for the planet side, and perhaps three for the outer cordon, simply because so many minds were needed to create a double shell around a planet. Other than that, it was simply a case of telling their program what they needed to do and where, scattering them, and the clever little things made their own way into position and formed their own communications net. They would stand guard for as long as it took, killing anything that tried to pass. They could even be deactivated and rounded up later, like an obedient flock.
Would have been a great idea to do that with Corellia.
But minds were indiscriminate killers, designed to be so, to send out a clear message that nobody could pass. The whole Corellian blockade had been as much a psychological lever, conceived at a time when Cal Omis had really thought that the war could end with talks, and when Jason could be curbed, and when casualties could still, so they had thought, bring everyone to their senses.
The mine layers are an hour into hyperspace,
Kenb said.
Give them an hour to deploy on reaching the target, and pull back outside the Fondorian limits.
Neothel had to let Luke know the full picture. He would only target Jason, but any commander needed wider context. She'd struggled with that decision on the short journey to HQ, because it would be as good as warning Fondor. And the crews and troops dragged along for Jason's jaunt were her people. She might have been signing their death warrants.
But if I balk at this, is there any useful intelligence I can safely give the Jedi? GA personnel will almost always be involved.
No, she couldn't be selective. She had to choose now. It was literally a sickening sensation.
If Fondor doesn't roll over,
when faced with the prospect of having one or two of its cities turned into a transperisteel parking lot, how is Jason going to occupy the planet?
He'd embarked with 150,000 troops. Taking 10 orbital yards would tie up most of them. And assuming they succeeded, it was labor-intensive to keep an eye on an industrial process where disgruntled workers would sabotage operations in 1,000 small places. It wasn't enough, even in the short to medium term. Jason's battle awareness was extraordinary. A Sith skill, Luke said. And he might very well have known something that she didn't, but it didn't guarantee he wouldn't run into problems, or that his crew would try quite as hard as they had before Tebbutt was killed. Morale was a subtle thing. It was often the difference between inspired actions and failure.
"What's the latest estimate of the strength of the Remnant Task Force?"
she asked.
"They're standing by with 20 Star Destroyers and carriers with air group embarked. Assorted cruisers, auxiliaries, landing craft, and fast patrol vessels. No firm numbers on personnel overall, but a first wave of 50,000 troops for the blockade. And they have small special forces units embarked to take strategic targets as required. They plan to join Colonel Solo just before the assault."
"I'd better talk to Pelion. See if he thinks this is genius or madness."
"I think I can guess what Gentleman Gill will say."
It was rather touching. Most personnel still had a soft spot for Pelion. Neothel didn't, but now that she had to work with him again, she'd find one temporarily.
"Very well. I'm finished for the day. If anything changes, calm me."
Neothel valued the transit time from HQ to the Senate. Her official speeder had tinted screens and soundproofing, and so it was a haven, a few minutes each day when she could clear her mind.
"Jason isn't stupid. Not stupid enough to try to take Fondor with a fraction of the troops he needs, anyway. I just hope the Imperials are as good as their word. I bet they think they're going to get Fondor as a bonus for their trouble."
Jason's vagueness about operational orders, part of his ad hoc way of running things lately, frustrated her immensely. It was all intangible feeling, force intuition, and too few hard numbers. It worked more often than not, but she still didn't like what she couldn't see and measure. Jason couldn't hold Fondor with those numbers unless the whole population capitulated. And even if governments did, citizens often had their own ideas about resistance. Either the Force was telling him Fondor was going to shrug and take it after a token exchange of fire, much as they skirmished on the limits of Fondor space and didn't take it much farther, or he was overestimating his chances. Maybe he had some Sith secret tactic that nobody had seen before. She rubbed her face wearily. Either way, Luke Skywalker needed to know the attack was imminent. The chauffeur dropped her off at her club for the evening, and instead of savoring that brief respite when the biggest decision she had to make was what to order from the menu, she swept her room for eavesdropping devices and then composed an encrypted data sheet for Luke Skywalker with every detail he might need. She wasn't sure how many Jedi had regrouped on Endor, but they had a way of punching way, way above their weight.
"Give him a punch for me, Luke."
When Luke appeared, she spoke quickly.
"Master Skywalker, Fondor will be ring-fenced by vigilante mines, double shell. I estimate 4 or 5 hours, and the fleet will follow shortly afterward."
Luke paused, as if he was visualizing that. "I think Fondor was expecting something after the skirmish with the Anakin Solo."
"Yes, that was provocative, but there's more. Jason's following at 2359 with part of the 4th Fleet and 150,000 troops.
He's planning to isolate the orbital yards by mines and force a surrender, or so he says. The Imperial Remnant is backing him up. I'm sending you the data now. I'll update it when I can.
What makes you think he might be lying?
He's Jason. It's what he does. I don't believe he's stupid either. Too few troops to take and hold both orbitals and planet, but a lot of capital ship firepower. My personal view is that he plans to draw the Fondorian forces out and then pound them so that the Imperials can move in.
The thoughts were rolling out as she spoke, ideas breeding.
But he's not invincible.
Is it a decoy attack?
I've seen no other ship movements or troop deployments that even hint that he's going to stage a bigger operation elsewhere.
Or a smaller one?
I just don't know. But I'm going to spend the evening briefing a few captains to get my people out, if this all goes to rot.
Thanks, Admiral.
You're welcome, Master Skywalker. Go ahead and ruin his day for me. And maybe my own people's day, too. I hope not. I really do.
Neothel wandered down to the dining room and tried to work up some enthusiasm for the menu, but she had lost all desire to eat. She sat gazing in defocus at the fine linen and gold-rimmed Naboo porcelain plate, and found that even the water she sipped stuck in her throat. She had been so certain that undermining Jason Solo was the right thing to do. But collateral damage could never be avoided. It was part of war. She sent beings into battle, and some didn't come back. But that was when she looked them in the eye, and more often than not stood on that same deck with them. She had never felt less worthy of the uniform in her life.